go. This hopefully should take no more than 10 minutes. Hopefully. So, this is it. Yes, this can do this now. No, Zoom recorders. This is the fashion these days. So, how did your career begin?
No, I'm just more interested in the microphone.
Well, this is an interesting app that I got. It's an internal microphone built inside it, and it picks up literally everything. I mean, I did an interview with Greg Wallace from MasterChef at the Glasgow SECC, and the noise that it picked up.
What's the app?
What app? What's it called?
Recorder Plus.
Recorder Plus.
So use that.
I recorded a nightingale using Recorder Plus.
Very nice. Very nice. But, so your career, when did it all begin?
No idea. I can't remember. How are you defining career?
Well, I noticed that it was quite interesting, last night you were talking to Al Murray, because he's got a degree in history, as have you, but then you went to do hospital radio.
Yeah, but I did, that's why I say, it depends what you're calling career, because I did student radio when I was at Warwick, and I did hospital radio after Warwick. That isn't a career.
That's true.
That's a hobby. But it was it was fantastic fun, and University Radio Warwick, which then got renamed W963, was fantastic. It wasn't working for a lot of the time I was at Warwick. Couldn't broadcast all of the campus, but got taken off air just before I joined because it was broadcasting to submarines, and the Ministry of Defence shut the university radio station down.
Whoops! Oh dear!
But that was great. And then hospital radio when I left, and then I started doing some voluntary stuff at Radio Brighton, as it was, and putting records away in their library. So I was always sort of trying to get in and doing stuff for no money. And then got a gig at Radio Nottingham, or a job, as I think it was called at the time, as a station assistant, which is just a great way in of starting. That was the start of the career, I suppose, in 1982, because you get paid and you get to do things on air and drive the radio car and produce other programs and choose music for other shows. And so you get so you get a chance to work on a whole variety of things.
In terms of your listenership for Radio 2, I know that that's a big audience because it's drive time in a prime time slot. How do you prepare for that?
You're assuming that there's preparation?
Well, I'm assuming. We've watched the show live from the Edinburgh Festival this week, so we're assuming.
Well, it works. I mean, it works.
Because I know that there's traffic and travel, obviously.
Well, there's some things that I don't have to worry about. The news, nothing to do with me. Travel, nothing to do with me. Sport, not my gig, that's Matt. Money, not my gig, that's Rebecca. So there are various slots that I don't have to have any responsibility for. The rest of it, I obviously do. So it starts very early. So I write my blog very early on. Then it has to go through the tortuous BBC system of compliance.
Oh, dear.
Philippa, and so that has to go up. So and I choose the oldest theme and everything. So it starts very early on in the day. Then I will do any show preparation that I need to do. So the work for the interview, whoever's coming on. So I do that in the morning. Then I'm going to do other things. Maybe I'll do some writing. Then I'll go. I'll be in the studio in the offices from about 3:30. So it's scattered through the day, but because the show is at one end of the day, I don't need to work on it all the way. That's the difference between the 2 gig and the 5 gig that I did, was that Radio 5 just fills every available space that you have, because you do so many different types of interview that it will just colonise every space that you've got. So with Radio 2, once I've sorted out the guest, and the other major thing is reading all the confessions, because most of them are rejected. Then the ones that are there, they have to be complied, they have to be sorted, and some words and phrases changed. So that takes time. I tend to do a week's worth all at once. It's scattergun all the way through the day.
In terms of the music side of things, is that all picked for you, even though it's a national station?
Most of it will be. So there's a head of music, and the producers meet and they decide what's on the A list and what's on the B list and what's on the C list and so on. So the music priorities are chosen elsewhere. But the rest of it is a consultation. So, when we're talking about the oldies, there's then a conversation about which oldies we play. And if I feel really strongly that I would really like to play this song by this artist, and if it can be accommodated, then and it's a sensible suggestion.
Of course, yes.
Then that can, you know, then that can be accommodated. But it's a very, very busy show, so there isn't a lot of room for musical preferences.
No.
Because it's so dense, because there are so many built features, we tend to have a few oldies and the rest of the playlist.
Yeah, because I was going to say, it's all very much timed because of the when it is. And I noticed that certainly from watching it, you know, for these two nights, it's all at 5:15, it's this, at 5:30,
oh, yeah,
it's this.
Yeah, you can, it's a bit like breakfast. I mean, it is like a bit like a breakfast show. You do, it is a clock. You can tell the time by the show. You can tell, well, unless we've got hopelessly off course.
Yes, unless you've got the, unless you don't look at the big red clock.
Yes, exactly. Which I still can't see.
In terms of, what is it that you have, can you define what it is that you've got that makes your drive time show stand out?
Really?
I don't know, it's yes and no questions. No, I mean, drive time is one of the great shows to have. My mother was a studio manager at the BBC with John Dunn. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the mid-50s. And John Dunn did Drive Time forever and was and got a set template for what Drive Time is. He did a 6 o'clock guest, you know, and he would talk to them for a long time and not play a record in between. And then in a radical innovation, they put a record in. And Johnny did that to a less extent, Helpful Drill. Chris didn't, but but Drive Time works, I think, because there's a tradition on, it feels to me as though it's in the tradition of what Drive Time has always been, but it's just happens to be me doing it.
Okay. How do you captivate your audience? How do you connect with them?
Why am I so talented? Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah, because it seems as though you've got your audience in a sense down to a T because it's so big.
I'd say is that for the first time in my life, I'm the target audience of the people I'm broadcasting to. When I was at Radio 1, when I joined, I was too old. Vibe Live, I was slightly too old for their target audience. Now people my age are target audience of Radio 2. So it's an instinct that you sort of know what a huge majority of your audience want and like and expect. But Radio 2 is so huge, the extremities are enormous. And once Radio 1 has given up on their listeners, which is happening earlier and earlier because they're focusing younger and younger, just pause for some scenery to go through. Radio 2 hoovers everybody up, you know. So, and Radio 2 feels like the way Radio 1 used to be. Radio 1 used to be the music station of default for the country. And it's not now because they are focused younger and the media has changed. But that's what Radio 2 is. So Radio 2 feels like the way Radio 1 used to be. And we have people, you know, early 20s to up until death. When I go around schools, I do a lot of schools visiting, talking about books and stuff at the moment. I tell this bemused audience of 10, 11, 12-year-olds that Radio 2 might not mean a lot to them at the moment, but like death and taxes, we'll get them in the end. And they... So, you know, it's just being part of a very large and very successful radio station.
Yeah. In terms of, where did the, because I know you've written a couple of books as well, which we have, which are very interesting to read, I must admit. Where did the inspiration for them come from?
The novels are the most surprising thing I've done because I was not expecting to do it.
No.
But in a nutshell, what happened was I'd left Radio 5, but I'd left Radio 5 with a big interest in science because we spoke to a lot of scientists. And my son, who was 10 at the time, came home from school and he wasn't really interested in sport and all the things that you'd expect a 10-year-old to be interested in. He was interested in particle physics. Which was, you know, slightly baffling to me. So when I had more time on my hands, having had 5, I thought I'd write him a short story. And then the short story became a very long story. And by the time I printed it off, it was 400 sides and about 90,000 words, you know. So, but it wasn't commissioned or anything.
No.
So it was part of... So once my son had read it and he said he enjoyed it and I could tell he was telling the truth because parents could tell these things, I thought, well, maybe I could find a bigger audience for it. So then found an agent and a publisher and it...
it's certainly an interesting thing. You didn't expect to be able to do that from...
No, no, I have absolutely no expectation to do it at all. But once I'd started, I thought, well, I'm going to do this. And I'm not going to... And I wanted... I didn't hand it in before I... Because my agent said, show me 30,000 words and I'll see if we can find someone who's interested. But I didn't want that. I didn't want to do that because I thought if someone says I'm not interested, I would stop and I wouldn't finish the story. And I wanted, for my own sake and for my son's sake, to finish the story, having invested so much time and effort into it.
Of course.
So I didn't show it to anyone at all until it was finished.
That's a good idea. We should go.
I can admit, I'm fighting at the moment, and I admit I don't show it to anyone because I think they can say, oh, this is wrong, that's wrong. With writing the book, was there anything that your publisher said that you needed to take out or change?
Well, it's a very interesting process. It's a very weird relationship, which is completely new to me, that a writer has with the editor. And it is just like handing in homework. I'd never written a novel before, so I knew there were going to be loads and loads of things to change. And there were loads and loads of things to change. But structurally, it's pretty much exactly the same. But characters have been altered and changed, the dialogue has been shifted and various bits have been turned around.
There wasn't any loss of any characters from Monday's show,
no? No, it wasn't. Ian Rankin, what a lightweight. His editor says, lose that character. No, but it was very, very painful. Because it's the most personal thing that you do. In radio, you're working with a team all the time. So you never do anything entirely on your own because you have engineers, you have producers, you have a broadcast assistant, you have a whole thing. If you're writing, it's just you. That's it. And these characters live in your head and they inhabit your head. And for a year, it was only me that knew about these people. And then all of a sudden, someone is writing to you saying, yeah, not convinced by Chloe. She just seems to get sick all the time. Why don't we just get rid of her? And I'm thinking... But she's it's your sister, you can't just get rid of her. How dare you? Oh yes, you're the editor. Sorry, you represent the publisher who bought the book. So anyway, that's an awkward and it's a difficult process.
Has there ever been a day when you were doing radio stuff that's gone totally wrong in terms of things not working, the show's gone down the pan, or...
Not really. I mean, the thing is, if you do the work, then the show will always be of a certain standard. And if you're working in music radio, the music will always be of a certain standard. So the highs and lows in music radio are much smaller than they are in speech radio. So that if you're working in speech radio, you live and die by the guests that you have on. In music radio, obviously, you live and die by the music. So the music is just always there. If I'm feeling terrible, feeling ill, just play more music. It's not a problem. But if you're doing a show on five, if the guests are rubbish, that's all you've got. You can't think, this guest is really terrible or embarrassing, I'll go and do something else, because there won't be anything else for you to go to. So there were some days at five which were more extreme than the days in Radio 2. But no, there hasn't been a day where the whole thing has been a disaster, fortunately.
He says.
Not yet.
He says. Now, I know you did, in 2012, you did the Blockbuster show.
I did.
How was that? What's the comparison between doing TV and doing radio? Is there any...
Radio is full of very nice people. That's the comparison.
Oh, that's
radio
nice.
Is full of people who in general treat you extremely well. And as a human being.
And TV.
It's an open-ended. No, it was... I had a fantastic time doing it. And it was... To do something like Blockbusters was a brilliant format. The audience loved it. The contestants loved it. The audience research showed how successful it was. There was a dreaded thing that happened, and I knew exactly what was going to happen. There was a management takeover. Some other people ran the station by the time I'd finished the show. So the people who bought it and said, let's do Blockbusters, by the time we finished it, they weren't there. And you know instinctively what's going to happen. That is, they want to have their own things. They want to have their own ideas. It was fun for a series, and that was that. But while I was doing it, it was good.
There was one I liked watching. It was the one where there was the three triplets, the identical triplets.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones.
Yeah, I saw that one. I thought, because I looked at them, I thought, wait a minute, they look very, very similar to each other. I thought, and then when you
mentioned, they were made for the show.
Indeed. In terms of your long, outstanding career since 1981, 1982. Been any highlights?
No, none at all. It's all been quite mundane.
Really? I don't believe that for a second.
No, it's difficult to... It's difficult. I mean, obviously, when people remember if you've done a good interview or if you've had a famous person on the show, or you remember like at five, obviously slightly different. I think it's not inappropriate to use a career highlight, but I was on air at 9/11 when the planes hit the two towers. So that whole thing happened within my show. So that was a memorable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But probably the most memorable program. But the highlights are in the ordinary. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you can make the ordinary special, that means, I think, that you've got the show right, because it's the Monday to Friday business that's the exciting bit. So if you've got a show where there is nothing special, nothing particularly stand out, an okay guest, you know, and yet you keep a standard and it's consistently entertaining, that's what I'm most proud of, you know. So I think doing the breakfast show for nearly 6 years, you know, with big figure, you know, with great audience, that I'm very proud of it. But I'm proud of it as a total, as a whole. Coming to Radio 2 and getting record drive time figures is fantastic. But that's like spread over 3 and a bit years. So I couldn't say it's that guest, it's that interview, it's that particular outside broadcast. So we're taking everything as a whole.
Well, what we'd like you to do is, because we're from a you've got one more thing, right?
With the confession section that you do, have you had, what has been your best confession you've had? And are there any in the book that you haven't been able to put on the show?
No, the ones in the book are all the ones that have been broadcast. There are loads that can't be broadcast. There are loads that are in the first three books that were broadcast on Radio 1, which wouldn't be broadcast now because the rules have changed. The most memorable one, just the one I always go back to, again, is one that wouldn't be broadcast now, but this is a Radio 1 confession, and it was a very short confession, and it came from a guy who worked in a hospital on the south coast somewhere. See, I'm still remaining sufficiently vague. And his job was to prepare people for operations, and on this particular day, I think he was hungover, not paying attention, and he had to shave the chest hair of this guy who's going in for a heart operation, and he wasn't concentrating while he was doing it, and before he knew what he'd done, he shaved off the guy's nipples.
That is a rather
and everyone reacts in the same way to that story. And for those reasons, it's particularly memorable.
That would be, I can understand that. Uh-huh. What we'd like to do is, because we're from a couple of stations, we actually incidentally work at the hospital radio stations as well, and our show starts when yours finishes, when we cut in a sense. So we're wondering if you could do a couple of sound bites for us. Would that be
like what?
Like, for example, for the Red Dot, you could say, "I'm Simon Mayo, and you're listening to Red Dot Radio, brought to you by the Edinburgh Hospital."
It's far too complicated. If you write that down, I'll. Take so many takes, it'd be embarrassing.
Just give me a shot.
You wouldn't comply that if you should have done.
I'm getting all the shit today, it's fine.
Yeah, but you know, but we'll change that, you know, and you know, so someone asked me that at one of the schools, actually, you know, of all the confessions, what's the one you remember the most? And I told that one. And it was a room full of, there was about 400 12-year-olds and their staff, and they all went.
Yeah.
All at the same time.
Oh, brilliant.